And a very good evening to you. I'm Kermit Poling, and tonight it's time for Health Matters. And as Mark said, we'll indeed be discussing issues with pregnancies, healthy pregnancies as well. And joining me in the studio are Dr. James Barrow and Dr. Tamara Richards. Both are assistant professors of OBGYN at LSU Health Shreveport. So first of all, thank you, doctors, for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And for those of you listening in, you're welcome to call in if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to make during the course of the show. Our number, as always, is 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. And we'd love to hear from our listeners this evening. So, pregnancy, I guess from the beginning, usually the first thing that happens is someone thinks that they're pregnant. And I think in this modern age, I think most women are inclined to take a home pregnancy test. Are some better than others? Is it better to do that, or just think and maybe go and see your doctor instead?
Tamara? Oh.
I think that it's probably better to go ahead and take a pregnancy test on your own. There's not one that's necessarily better than another test, but I think that it's a good idea to go ahead. If you have any suspicion, you can go ahead and take it on your own and then call your doctor for an appointment, and you can verify the pregnancy at that time.
Okay. And why is that? Why would it be better to do that? Just
because that's the first thing we're going to do when you
get first thing you're
exactly.
Gonna do. I like that. That's
save a great step.
That's it. That makes a whole lot of sense. So a woman has taken a test and she finds out that she's pregnant or suspects that she's pregnant, wants some confirmation. Why don't you talk about a little bit about what the typical visit is like the very first time someone comes in?
So the first visit, we take a general history, do a general physical exam. Usually we date the pregnancy, which means you get a ultrasound and we try to figure out how far along your pregnancy is. Sometimes that matches when your last period was. Some women have irregular periods, so that can be off. So it's real important to see your doctor at least a couple of weeks after first getting that positive pregnancy test.
Mm-hmm. And then how frequently, typically, assuming that the woman is going to see her doctor regularly, what is generally recommended? What kind of a schedule from that point onward?
During the first trimester, we usually see patients every 4 to 5 weeks as long as they're not really having any problems. And then as we get closer to the due date, we start seeing patients more frequently. And generally by the end, we're seeing them almost every week.
And I know, typical, a woman's going to gain weight during a pregnancy, but I know that there are issues for some that gain too much weight, some that gain too little. What's a healthy medium and why?
Well, that's a little controversial. It depends
like
on
controversy.
Exactly. it depends on what body, national body or organization. There's several guidelines, but a typical normal weight lady, 15 to 20 pounds is adequate. We do kind of follow the growth of the baby throughout the pregnancy through measuring the mother's uterine height every time she comes in, and if that's off, then we will get an ultrasound to check the growth of the baby.
Mm-hmm. So what are the dangers of gaining too much weight or not gaining enough?
There's conditions like hypertensive disorders in pregnancy, diabetes. Mm-hmm. It also makes the weight harder to lose after pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. In terms of a diet that's recommended now, and of course there are many women who are also vegetarians and vegans, so we're looking at a wide variety of diets. What's generally recommended?
I think the only thing you got to worry about if you're a vegetarian or a vegan is to make sure and get enough iron, because the iron requirements in pregnancy go up because your blood volume goes up because you need more blood to get to the placenta and oxygenate the baby. So that's the only thing I would say about a vegan or a vegetarian diet, is to make sure and get plenty of iron, and you can do that through supplementation or eating foods that are fortified with iron.
Okay. What about supplements? Either supplements like vitamins or maybe additional supplements for protein or something like that?
We usually recommend just taking a regular prenatal vitamin. Mm-hmm. We generally check an iron level in our patients. So if there's worry that a patient is anemic, then they could take extra iron on top of that. The other thing you could also take is additional folic acid to help with neural tube defects or something like that.
What about things like alcohol, caffeine consumption?
So alcohol is a definite no-no. Mm-hmm. there are no good studies that say how many drinks are okay, so we just recommend no alcohol during pregnancy. A common question we do get is a patient doesn't know they're pregnant early on, and they might have a glass of wine or a cocktail or something like that, and that's okay. But generally, you run into problems if you drink throughout the entire pregnancy. As far as caffeine, I'll let Dr. Richards talk about that.
Usually try to keep that at a minimum. I usually tell my patients not to they don't have to completely cut it out, but keeping it down to about one cup of coffee a day or the equivalent of that.
Okay. All right. We're talking about pregnancy this evening, and my guests, Dr. James Barrow and Dr. Tamara Richards, both are assistant professors of OBGYN at LSU Health Shreveport. And if you would like to call in with a question for the doctors, or perhaps if you have a comment, tonight's the time to call. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. I know that smoking can be a real issue related to concerns with pregnancy. Can you talk a little bit about those as well?
Smoking can cause your baby to be very small and have some growth restriction. It also causes an increase in problems later on during pregnancy, including an abruption and stuff like that. So we usually recommend to cut out smoking completely if possible.
The other bad thing about smoking is after delivery, if you continue to smoke, the newborn baby can be exposed to that and can have babies that are exposed to secondhand smoke have more trips to the doctor for upper respiratory issues. So it matters in pregnancy and after pregnancy. So we always try to get people to quit while they're pregnant. That's usually a good motivating factor to get patients
to quit. How often do you see that?
It's not as common as it used to be.
That's what I was wondering.
Less and less people are smoking, I think, and we don't see that as much as, you know, when I was a resident 10 years ago.
What about exercise? I know my mom has told me, I'm going to my own history here, and that's way from the last century, that in her day, mothers were told, you know, to relax and take it easy and not do much. But I think in our current era, you know, exercise is recommended. Is that true?
Yes, that's something that's changed over the last several years. The current recommendations are that you can continue the current level of activity that you are doing before you were pregnant. The only thing that you would be worried about is any kind of trauma to the abdomen while you're doing exercise. So very vigorous activities, you know, something like CrossFit or something else that you could have potential falls on your abdomen as you get further along in pregnancy, it would probably be avoidable. We would recommend, you know, not doing those, but anything else is probably okay.
And just basically related to that, working schedules and all of that, I know it used to be that a woman would take off work at some point, and we have all kinds of family leave laws and all of that are in for that type of thing, but it seems to me that more and more women are pretty much working almost up to the delivery date.
Yeah, we have residents that are you know, training to be OBGYNs, and they work, I think recently one of them worked right up until 5 o'clock, and then she checked herself into the hospital and had her baby that night. So it's
or they're trying to experience both ends of
exactly
it. Good learning
it's
experience.
Not a disease state, it's a normal state, and you can do pretty much your normal activities within reason.
I know it's related to exercise, and people are concerned about their appearance and all of that, but I think stretch marks are inevitable. What exactly causes that?
Yeah, it's kind of unknown. There's different women have different types of skin. Different women gain different amounts of weight during pregnancy. For example, if a woman has twins, her belly's obviously going to be a little bit bigger than somebody who has a singleton baby. So there's lots of factors, race, skin types, things like that, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it, unfortunately. They sell lots of creams and lotions and things like that, and you know, I always tell people if they want to try it, but you know, I wouldn't spend a whole lot of money on you know, some miracle stretch mark cream.
Sure, that makes sense. We talk a little bit now about the testing, that recommendations that you all might have in the various trimesters and all of that, because I know a lot of testing has been in the news recently, and of course there are some tests that have been around a while, but my understanding is that, and especially just this year, there have been some interesting new discoveries. So talk a little bit about the testing that you would recommend during the especially the first trimester.
during the first trimester, we usually get our routine prenatal labs, which consist of checking your iron levels. We generally do basic STD screening, and we check a blood type. That would be the things that we, for a normal pregnancy in the first trimester. Then you can, as the pregnancy goes along, you can get something called a cell-free fetal DNA that can test for a certain kind of birth defects. That's one of the things that's coming out that's newer.
That's probably the thing that you're referring to.
There were stories just going back to last January. In fact, I remember mm-hmm. NPR doing
it's a new
story
test.
On that.
It's not well understood, and that's one of the big problems. And right now our governing body, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, is trying to decide where that particular test fits into prenatal testing. And right now it's recommended for women over the age of 35. It's not recommended that they have it, but it's an option. Mm-hmm. And it only tests for the sex of the baby and duplications of, I think, 3 or 4 chromosomes. So it's very limited in what it can do. And it's still, like I said, not, there's a lot of still controversy on what the role of that test is going to be in routine prenatal testing.
Is it a test that you are doing yet?
Yes.
Yes.
You are. Okay.
Yes.
All right. And I'm coming at this as a non-physician, but a lot of what it seems to test for, even though it isn't complete, seems to be to parallel what I think is called AFP screening, or at least it has some similar results. What are the differences?
It overlaps that a little bit. Yeah, there's a screening test that the traditional screening test is called a quad screen.
Okay.
And it tests for neural tube defects and the trisomies, like Down syndrome and some other duplications of the chromosomes.
Right.
So the cell-free DNA tests for those particular chromosomes, but it does not test for neural tube defects, which is actually what the AFP test for. So you have to get your cell-free DNA, and then you have to get a separate AFP drawn as well.
Right. So it doesn't really replace anything at this point.
Not exactly.
It's
hard. Additional test.
I'll tell you what people like it for the most. Mm-hmm. You can find out the sex of your baby at the very beginning of your pregnancy.
Yes.
So I guess you really want to know. That's the way to do that. You had mentioned, you just made a reference to a woman over 35, and I know that age plays a role in risks. Can you talk a little bit about what those risks are?
Well, we call that advanced maternal age, although that's probably not the best
not
term.
Not that old.
To tell a female patient when she comes in that she's 35 and that she has advanced maternal age. But that's sort of the accepted cutoff in obstetrics for an increased risk of really just Down syndrome and some other genetic issues. And so when they're over 35, it just necessitates that they go see a high-risk OB doctor for a consult, and they just do a very targeted ultrasound and make sure that the baby is okay.
Okay. So what are some of the, what are some of the things in addition to that, that they'll be looking for? How is their treatment going to be different?
When they do the targeted ultrasound, they're going to be looking at the baby's heart, the baby's intestinal tract, and other things that are markers for problems like Down syndrome or other birth defects. And so if those are discovered at that point in time, the patient could be offered an amniocentesis, which is really the only definitive test of testing for any of those disorders. If nothing's found, then generally there's not much difference in the way that their prenatal care is handled.
Okay. And if the tests come out positive, showing a problem, what happens next?
Well, that's just kind of a parental choice. And if they have a baby, if they have a problem like Down syndrome or something, then we manage it like a normal pregnancy, and not much else different to do, but the parents are aware of it before the delivery. Some people choose to have no prenatal genetic testing in the first mm-hmm. and second trimester because they don't, you know, they're not going to, it's not going to change anything in their mind. They're not going to do anything differently. That's also a choice. So some women decline prenatal testing.
Yesterday, I was listening to a program that we air on our 3 channel, the Diane Rehm Show, and they were having pretty much this exact same discussion by coincidence. And that was one of the issues that came up. And one of the callers that called into that program basically said the same thing, that they didn't, you know, it really wasn't going to matter anyway. That was followed by a caller who ended up getting a positive result on which, I forget which test it was, and they were concerned about that there was a birth defect, and they weren't going to do anything anyway, but they worried about it. This was, I guess, about halfway through the pregnancy. And then when the baby was born, there were no issues, so it was a false positive. How often does that come up?
Pretty often. There's a lot of markers that are just kind of soft markers that make us maybe a little bit more concerned, where we may do further testing, but there's nothing definitive, and none of that can be really discovered until the baby is born. Mm-hmm. The only way to definitively discover most of that stuff would be through an amniocentesis. And so if we see markers that aren't very strong indicators of a problem, we're probably, because of the risks associated with amniocentesis, we're probably not going to advise a patient to get that unless they're absolutely 100% really worried or going to do something with the pregnancy if something were to come back on that.
There is one exception to that. If they have mm-hmm. an open neural tube defect, that means part of their spinal cord is not covered by the normal layers and is actually exposed outside the skin. And sometimes that's good to know before the baby's born, because you can arrange pediatric surgery, the pediatric neurosurgeon and people like that if there is a need to intervene. And so sometimes that's a good thing. You know, the only definitive way is what, like Dr. Richard said, is to get an amniocentesis. And I think what some people don't understand, too, is when you get the quad screen, when they draw the AFP, and there's three other labs that they draw, it doesn't tell you that it's that the test is positive or negative. It quotes you a risk. So the population has a general risk of Down syndrome if one of the markers is high. If the markers are normal of, say, 1 in 350, I can't remember the exact numbers, for a 35-year-old. Well, if the marker, if the blood level's a little bit elevated, then your risk may go to 1 in 250 mm-hmm. from 1 in 350. So it doesn't say you have it. It just says your chances of having it are higher. And so I think that's a thing that sometimes – and sometimes we don't do a great job of explaining that to patients, and that's something they should understand. But if they want a definitive diagnosis, whether they have it or not, then they have to do an amniocentesis, which is where you place a needle into the mother's uterus, and you take fluid from around the baby, the amniotic fluid, and they send it off to a lab and grow the cells out and culture them and run DNA tests on them.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about ectopic pregnancies. What exactly is that? How often do you see that, and what happens?
An ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy that's located outside of the uterus, so somewhere where it's not supposed to be. Generally, mm-hmm. this is going to be in the fallopian tube. Sometimes it can be up in the corner of the uterus and various other places. Occasionally it can be out in the abdomen somewhere, but generally these pregnancies are not viable because they don't have the appropriate tissue to grow or the space to grow, and so this is usually a life-threatening condition for the mother.
Sure. We're talking about pregnancies this evening with my guests. We have Dr. James Barrow and Dr. Tamara Richards, both assistant professors of OBGYN at LSU Health Shreveport. This is Health Matters, and of course, your questions and comments are welcomed as well. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. Again, the number 800-552-8502. Talk a little bit how technology, the developments of technology, have changed what you do comparatively maybe to someone that was doing what you're doing 20 years ago or 25 years ago.
Well, I think the best example is ectopic pregnancy. People used to die of this condition all the time. And with the advent of better and better ultrasound, we can diagnose that condition really, really early on and either intervene surgically or with medicine and with surgery, you remove the pregnancy, and with medicine, it causes an abortion basically in the tube, and can save the mother's life.
You mentioned changes in the ultrasound. So the technology has developed. What is better about ultrasounds now than in the past?
They're just more powerful. Vaginal probe ultrasound has these aren't really recent things, but you know, 30 or 40 years ago, lots more women died of ectopic pregnancy. Pregnancy tests were not as sensitive as they are now. A pregnancy test now can detect a pregnancy that's like...
three and a half weeks pregnant.
Yeah, wow. Which is, you know, fertilization occurred maybe a week, up to, you know, 3 to 5 days after fertilization, the pregnancy test can pick it up. And so that's kind of a double-edged sword. That's why we're laughing. But things like that have made a big difference.
Okay, we have our first caller calling in at 800-552-8502. This is Denise from Shreveport. Denise, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I do not have a question about pregnancy. However, it is a GYN question. And in the news today, we hear a lot about the female Viagra. So I'm wondering, do we think the use of that will lead to sex addiction with women?
Okay. We're maybe having a technical issue here. Tamara, did you hear the call?
Yes.
It's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question. I don't know that I can answer that. That pill just became available. The FDA just approved that yesterday, I believe. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. I don't really know.
I'm having trouble hearing through my...
Okay, the question about Viagra for women.
Oh yeah, it was FDA approved yesterday, and it's a new drug. It was an antidepressant that they were studying in Germany, and it did not work out as an antidepressant. And one of the side effects they found of the drug was that it increased arousal or the need for sexual episodes. So they tried. Put the drug back through studies, and it just recently got approved. It's really, really not very effective. The data show that it increased the desire for sexual activity. Maybe it was 0.7 times per month. So I guess that's better than zero. But it increased about one sexual episode per month by taking the medicine every day. So... I don't think it's going to lead to any
addictions,
addiction disorders, or anything like that.
No.
Well, Denise, thank you for your question.
Thank you.
And the number to call in if you have a comment or question is 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. And do you want to? It is plugged into to there. We're having a headphone issue here. You might try plugging it into one of the other ones and just see what happens there, seeing if that makes a difference. And we'll see if we can get that straightened out, because it helps to hear the phone calls. I guess a big difference.
I got it.
There we go. All right.
Mic is working.
Got to be plugged in. Okay. Well, wonderful. So let's get back to some of the other issues that are related to the pregnancy. One thing that you mentioned earlier, you just kind of went through a short list, but talked about risks of diabetes and that type of thing. How frequently do you see that? What is there any aspect of it that's different from type 2? I know it's a gestational diabetes. What are the issues related to that?
We actually see it pretty frequently. The main issue with gestational diabetes is the concern for very large babies. These patients have a tendency to have much larger babies than patients without gestational diabetes. So that's usually our biggest concern as far as gestational diabetes goes. And we typically test for that in the second trimester.
Great. And I know some women experience cramping or pains during their pregnancy, and some get very concerned about it. What type of pains are normal and what aren't normal prior to going into labor?
Well, you can have different pains throughout your entire pregnancy. Generally, in the second trimester is when pain starts that we usually refer to as round ligament pain, which is kind of a lower pain in your pelvis that kind of, it feels like some stretching or pulling that can extend all the way down into your vagina. And this is just while the uterus is growing and stretching out all those ligaments as the baby is increasing in size. And then as you get closer to delivery, you can start having contractions. You know, some patients describe this as cramping. They feel like their abdomen is tightening up. Sometimes patients experience back pain, especially as they're uterus is getting larger, their posture changes, and so they can experience back pain from that.
What about bleeding during pregnancy?
Bleeding during pregnancy is not usually normal. However, you can have spotting on and off. So bleeding, heavy bleeding like a period would be cause for concern. But bleeding after having sex or having an exam when you come into the clinic can be normal. And having spotting on and off when you go to the bathroom or something would not be as concerning as, you know, bleeding a lot.
Okay, we have a question coming in, and you can, if you don't want to go on the air, that's absolutely fine. You can just let whoever takes your call know that you have a question. And actually, we have two that are coming up. One is going to be sort of related to what we were just talking about, I think, wanting to know what Braxton Hicks contractions are.
So Braxton Hicks contractions, they usually start around 35 to 36 weeks. One misconception is we have patients that come in and say they're having Braxton Hicks contractions when they're 26, 27 weeks, when they're very, very preterm. If you have those are not normal. Those are not Braxton Hicks. You should go to the labor unit or you should call your physician, because that could be an early sign of preterm labor. Braxton Hicks are the beginnings of labor. They're false contractions, they're called, and they happen around 35, 36 mm-hmm. weeks.
Okay, and the other question that was called in concerns the ultrasounds again. They want to know how often they're usually done, and specifically, what are you looking for in the first, second, and third trimesters?
So we usually do two ultrasounds at a minimum. We do an initial ultrasound when you come in for your initial OB visit, where we get a dating scan. At that point, we're mm-hmm. looking to see how far along you are. We measure the baby, we look for a heartbeat. If all of that looks normal, then we usually schedule a anatomy scan, which would be later on, roughly around 17 to 18 weeks gestational age. And at that point, that's when we're looking at the anatomy. That's usually when people find out whether they're having a boy or a girl. We look at the brain, we look at the heart, we look at most of the other organs. If everything looks normal, there's not usually a reason to have another ultrasound. We may get one more a little bit later on during pregnancy, but usually there's not a reason for one. Obviously, if we see anything abnormal at that point, we would get a more targeted ultrasound and send our patient to a high-risk OB doctor, and they would do the ultrasound at that point.
Okay. Our next question is from Janet from Bossier City. Janet, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I have a question. I am a carrier of fragile eggs, and I would like to have a baby one day. And I was just wanting to know, would that carry on to my baby, the fragile egg syndrome? What I have to do to possibly prevent that?
That would be a situation where you want to come in, get some prenatal counseling, maybe get a referral to a geneticist and a high-risk OB doctor, and let them let your OB, the geneticist, and the high-risk OB doctor all kind of work as a team and work through that.
And what is she specifically asking about?
She's asking about Fragile X.
Okay. All right. Does that answer your question for you, Janet?
We don't see that a whole lot, but we would definitely get a geneticist involved to help us to give good advice on that.
Okay, and the number to call with your question this evening, 800-552-8502. Again, the number, 800-552-8502. We talked a little bit about the risks of an older woman becoming pregnant. And I guess the question sort of assumes that, well, maybe that just happened. But what if an older woman wants to become pregnant? What are some of the interventions to help her in that situation?
Well, I guess you have to define older.
I was going to say, first off, we should not call a 35-year-old older woman.
Well, now you called it advanced, yes.
Advanced maternal age.
I'm just going
OB.
By what you all said.
We never call any woman older when they come to the office.
There we go.
We want to stay in business.
If they're having difficulty getting pregnant, we usually would refer them to a reproductive endocrinologist to do an evaluation and workup to see whether or not the female is ovulating. Anytime there's a problem with infertility, it could be a problem with the female or there could be a male factor. And so we would evaluate both the female and the male. If there seems, depending on what problem there is, then you could move forward with treatment. And those would include giving medication, doing intrauterine insemination, or potentially doing IVF.
And you can get your basic workup with your OBGYN. Most OBGYNs in town will do a basic fertility workup. And fertility does decrease the older you get, but it's still there's still high rates of fertility in women over 35.
Okay. And just for clarity, IVF
is? In vitro fertilization, yes.
Okay. All right. Another question. This is Kim from Shreveport. Kim, you're on the air. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I'm a 46-year-old woman, and I am dating now a younger man, but I'm experiencing vaginal dryness. What can be done for that?
Well, you'd want to talk to your doctor and maybe get some hormone replacement therapy. That was a show about 2 or 3 months ago, though.
And the hormone, you can follow up on that if you want a little bit.
So you just talk, 46, average age of menopause is 51. So some women are starting to go through menopause a little bit early. And if you're starting to have signs of that, like vaginal dryness, hot flashes, things like that, then that's a good time to talk to your OBGYN and take care of some of the other health issues that come up, like cholesterol, preventative care for heart disease, for colon cancer, for breast disease, for cervical cancer. It's a great time to go see your doctor and talk about all those things, and then also get your hormone replacement therapy, and that will it's very, very easily treatable.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Kim, thank you so much for your call. And if you haven't guessed, we are talking primarily about pregnancy this evening on this edition of Health Matters. And my guests are Dr. James Barrow and Dr. Tamara Richards. They're both assistant professors of OBGYN at LSU Health in Shreveport. And we certainly do welcome your call at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. A question that also came in concerning heart palpitations. Is it common for women to experience those while pregnant, and when could those be a concern?
It could be. Sometimes early in pregnancy, you can have a more rapid heart rate. But if it tends to be happening frequently, especially if the patient's not exercising, she's just sitting down reading or doing quiet activities, then I would be a little concerned. And at that point, I would have her come in and evaluate her for that.
We have another question that came in. This is related in some ways to some of what we've talked about. I want to talk a little bit more about the risks of pregnancy after 35, what you call that advanced age, not just for the mom, but also for the babies as well.
So the main risk when they're talking about the advanced maternal age is really just the risk of Down syndrome goes up. And that's really Down syndrome and some other genetic issues are the rates of those are increased after 35. And that would be a baby born with Downs or some other conditions that are incompatible with life. And so those are the main issues for after 35. Another thing for older women, having babies, which a lot of women are doing because they're delaying childbirth for careers and school and things like that, are twins. And so the twin rate has actually gone up because more people are having their delaying childbirth till a little bit later in life. So that's another effect of that.
And does with in vitro fertilization or any of the chance for all of that also increase?
Yes, that does increase. That's why typically now when they are implanting, most REI doctors will only implant 1 to 2 embryos as opposed to 5 or 6, because there are risks associated with having twins and having triplets, and the more babies that you have, your risk of preterm labor and having other problems during the pregnancy goes up.
Okay. Miscarriage seems to be in the news again. I think it was Mark Zuckerberg who recently shared that his wife had 3 miscarriages. How common are they, and what are the risks for miscarriage?
Miscarriage is very, very common, and it's a thing that a lot of people don't talk about.
And you know, why not anymore in this day and age? You know, it's certainly a risk.
I'm not sure. I think probably patients are, I'm not sure. I don't think people understand how common it is. And they think that, you know, they're special and that they're the only ones that are dealing with it. But at least 10% of known pregnancies end in miscarriage. And there's a lot of pregnancies where patients may not know that they were pregnant and they just had a later period or something where they could have actually been pregnant. But, I mean, 10% is quite a bit. And so...
Because that's a fair amount.
Yes. And so I think there's a lot of heartache that's involved with miscarriage. And so having announcing your pregnancy and then having to go back and say that you miscarried can be very difficult. And so I think that's why some people don't like to share that.
And I'm sorry, go on. And I always encourage patients to do is to not tell everybody that they're pregnant when they get that that urine pregnancy test. I always encourage them to see their doctor and get that first ultrasound. If you see your doctor and you get an ultrasound and they see a little heartbeat on your ultrasound, then that's a good sign. And most of those pregnancies do not end in miscarriage. Most of those go on to be a regular pregnancy. But before you see that heartbeat, I would delay telling family and friends, and that will save you maybe some extra heartache if your pregnancy does end in miscarriage.
Sure. Well, Dr. Richards, Dr. Barrow, you both mentioned heartache associated with the miscarriage. What if someone has suffered through that, what do you then recommend? And are there support systems in place in that case?
There are. I think that's why in some ways it's difficult to not tell your family that you were pregnant and then to have to go back and tell your family that not only were you pregnant, but now you're going through a miscarriage because you do need support. And so if this is something that you have gone through in the past, then you may want to tell a select few once you have that positive UPT so that, or urine pregnancy test, so that if something bad were to happen, you were to have that support system. There are, I'm sure, various support systems online, but I think that's where your friends, your family, any kind of support that you have in your church or whatever becomes very important. And I think that's what we're seeing now with people being a little bit more open about it in the news and on Facebook and social media, that it's not something to necessarily hide or be ashamed of.
To realize a lot of people have gone through the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been talking a lot about leading up to the delivery and all of that. But what about the delivery itself? Because you read about different birthing techniques. And, you know, I remember going through that with, you know, when my son was born and you know, helping and doing what I could and helping with the breathing and all that. What are the birthing techniques available?
Well,
I know it's going to happen anyway, but what guidance do you provide?
One good thing to do before it actually gets time to pack the bag and go to the hospital is to go to a birthing class. And all the hospitals around town offer them. We have a nurse in our practice, Hillary Talent, that does the mm-hmm. birthing classes. And I think that's probably one really good thing for patients to do. And they talk about breathing techniques and pain control and all that. But I guess kind of when it gets time, we just kind of coach the patient to push and, you know, everything kind of.
There's a wide variety of opinions on how the birthing process should go. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who are lay people have their own opinions. So it really varies from person to person. You know, some people want to go all natural and don't want to have an epidural or any kind of pain medicine.
I know that comes up a lot.
Yes. Other people want all the drugs possible. You know, some people want to have their baby at home, which we do not recommend. But there's a wide spectrum of beliefs and ideas on how to properly have a baby.
And the easiest thing is just to have a discussion with your doctor. Most physicians that I know are very flexible. And we'll accommodate a wider range of birth plans or things like that during labor.
Sure.
And I think the most important thing is to be flexible, because there's a lot of patients who come in with a birth plan and an idea of how it's supposed to go. And babies, even starting in the uterus, don't really follow any kind of plans.
They don't follow the plan.
No, they don't follow the plans once they get out, but they certainly don't follow the plans once before they get out. And so to be flexible and to try to keep up that communication with your doctor throughout the whole process.
Our number to call for Health Matters this evening is 800-552-8502. Again, the number 800-552-8502 related to that. When does it become necessary to do a cesarean?
There's a wide variety of indications for cesarean. Probably the hottest topic, though, about cesarean section now is cesarean on demand. So some women electively choose to have a C-section rather than undergo a vaginal birth. And that's a controversial topic as well. But conditions like I think some things that are changed that have changed is we used to deliver babies in a breech position. So instead of head down, they were head up. And that used to, we used to deliver those vaginally, and most obstetricians now will do a C-section for that. If there's a placental disorder, if the baby's in distress in labor, so we monitor the baby's heart rate, and if the fetal heart rate is having issues, then that's an indication for a C-section. If you've had a couple of C-sections, that's an indication. So there's various indications.
Since you mentioned that the cesarean on demand is controversial, where do you two come in on that? You having a particular opinion?
I always just talk to the patient, and it's a reasonable request, and I talk to them and I tell them the pros and cons to C-section. I tell them the pros and cons to vaginal delivery, and you know, if that's what they want to do, I respect that, and I think Tamara feels the same way, and if that's what they want to do, then I'm okay with it.
Relating to the advanced patients we were talking about, are there any issues that happen during delivery that are different or of concern?
Not really.
Yeah. We have a texted in question here. Why do we hear about strep B now and test for it when we used to not do that? And how does having strep B affect delivery?
Well, this is something that can cause the baby to be very sick. After delivery, the baby can get sepsis and become very ill. And so we now test for it. If a patient comes back positive for the group B strep, then we treat the patient with antibiotics during delivery in an effort to prevent the baby from contracting it as it goes through the birth canal and possibly getting sick later on.
And it's not an STD. That's a common misconception that patients have. It's not an STD. It's just a bacteria. And it's transient. And so you can have it one pregnancy and not have it. You can have it early in your pregnancy and not have it late in the pregnancy. And so we only test for it right towards the end of pregnancy, like Tamara said, to make sure if they have the bacteria, then it's real simple. You give them some penicillin and that takes care of it.
Okay. We do have another caller. This is Marcus from Nacogdoches. Marcus, you're on the air. Go ahead with your question.
Thanks for having me on. My question had to do mostly with the delivery process from the male's point of view. I've had several conversations with women from my past, a serious conversation about in the room or out the room. Should I be in there? I've heard women vehemently say, I don't want you anywhere near the room. I've heard, I don't want you in the room. And I was just wondering, is there any hard evidence as far as what the man should do, or is it mostly just a personal preference? And I'd just like to hear your opinion on that. Thanks.
I don't think there's any evidence. I think as long as you're being supportive and then it's okay to be in there.
I would agree.
It's just up to the mother.
Mother, yes.
Yeah. So. Ultimately, it's up to her. But from personal experience, if you would all have the opportunity to be in there, I highly recommend it.
Oh yeah, it's an amazing experience.
And you can be in the room and not see anything. We have plenty of dads who don't want to see anything going on, and so they just stand up by their wife's head and can be supportive.
Everything's covered up.
Yeah.
And so,
well, I was told my father was in the delivery room when I was born, and he fainted. So
that is a concern. If
does
you
that
do
happen?
Stay in the yes, it does.
It really does.
If you stay in the room, you have to be prepared to hit the floor because we're more concerned about the patient and the baby than we are about the dad.
Sure, that makes sense. The number to call if you have a question, 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. We only have about 14 more minutes left in the program tonight. So if you've been waiting for your opportunity to call with your question or comment, go ahead and do that right now. 800-552-8502. So we have another caller that didn't want to go on the air. That's fine. And they want to know about the trend of planned deliveries, which might have been relating to what you were saying earlier. Are they as safe for mom and babies as waiting to go into labor naturally?
Yes, and that's a common question we get all the time now. And I think probably by planned delivery, she means either planned C-section or an induction of labor. And induction used to get a bad rap. And one of the big reasons is they used to think that induction caused an increase in cesarean rate. And they have just not found that to be the case in more recent studies and bigger studies and studies that were designed better. And so usually you cannot be induced before 39 weeks unless it's a medical condition, and that's a nationwide push to decrease NICU admissions. But after 39 weeks, again, if you want to have an induction for any reason, there's no real disadvantage to that compared to waiting for labor to come naturally.
One of the things I generally caution my patients if they do want an induction, though, is that it could potentially take a little bit longer as opposed to a patient coming in, contracting regularly, that's in labor. If we're actually inducing the process, not always, but it has the potential to take a little bit longer.
Okay, we've got another question. This is Norm from Bossier City. Norm, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I was just calling. I was curious about something. I have been married for like 18 years, and in my marriage, I had a vasectomy, and I was just wondering, would that process be able to be reversed? Should I meet somebody that wanted to have kids again?
Yeah, you'd want to talk to your urologist. And there are procedures as well to remove sperm, and you could see a fertility doctor, a female fertility doctor, with your partner, and they could tell you all the options. But
those are usually reversible.
Okay. Well, thanks, Norm. Thanks for your question. There's another listener who is from Bossier also, wants to know. Both your opinions on home birth and water birth.
Well, we typically don't recommend home birth. Studies have shown that it's more dangerous for the baby and the patient. So we typically recommend patients delivering in a hospital. We certainly try to make that as homey as possible, but we have all the doctors and nurses and everything else that's necessary in case of an emergency in a hospital as opposed to being at home. As far as a water birth goes, if that's what you want, I don't usually perform those, but actually I've never performed one, but
there's always a first time.
There is always a first time.
This comes up a lot. There's a big push. Another sect of our profession is our midwives that, and usually it's midwives that do home births. Mm-hmm. And if you had a midwife on the show, she would tell you that home births are safe. And so there's a big controversy there. And so as an obstetrician, I would say you have to just be really careful about that. You'd really want to make sure there's all levels of midwives. There's some that go through, they have to be a nurse first, and then they have to do an extensive training program to do that. And then there's another type of midwife that you can actually get without being a nurse. And those are the primary providers that are usually providing that are doing home births. And so you want to really check into who that was. And but our college and our stance is that we don't recommend home births, and water births we don't have a tub or technology at our hospital to do that.
What's supposed to be the presumed advantage of that? If there is one, I mean, it's...
I think maybe perhaps more comfortable for the patient, maybe more natural.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
It's not a common question, really. It's not something that we get asked a lot.
No.
Sure. Well, I've heard of it, and
it was a good question.
It is a really good.
It stumped us.
we'll put that on the next show. So maybe something in more detail. Who knows? We'll do another one on that. Question. Oh, we have another caller, so we'll go ahead and take this caller once it's pushed into the board here. They haven't quite gotten it transferred yet, so I'll go on with this one. What are some of the symptoms that a mother might be experiencing postpartum depression after delivery, and then how is that treated?
The symptoms of postpartum depression are basically the same symptoms you would have of depression at any time. It's just specifically during that postpartum period. They would have feelings of sadness, feelings of depression, difficulty sleeping, anxiety, but some of that is difficult because you also have some of those issues just with having a baby without being depressed. So some patients, there's a broad spectrum of a disorder. So you can have postpartum blues that really only last for a couple of weeks. It's very transient, and this is very normal in the postpartum period and not something that we would typically treat a patient for. However, if this is prolonging and really affecting your daily life and it goes on for much longer than 2 weeks, then we would be a little bit more concerned and may start a patient on medication and treat her.
Okay. I know it comes up a lot. You hear a lot about it. Mm-hmm. Does it tend to be more severe in terms of the depression, or is it just...
Well, I think one of the issues is you have a newborn baby, and
yes.
Anybody that's had a newborn baby understands. I'm sure you remember the sleepless nights and,
yeah.
You know, waking up to feed and all those things. Yep. And so, you know, mothers are real anxious about their newborn babies and trying to do a good job and making sure they get everything they can. And you know, you couple that with these feelings of depression. So, yeah, I guess it could feel more severe, and it could be a bigger issue.
One of the biggest issues I think that women with postpartum depression have is they have a difficulty bonding with their infant. And so that's a big sign for somebody who's going through postpartum depression, is they don't they just have difficulty bonding or feeling that mothering attitude that we typically see in a mother. They're very detached. And so at that point, I would definitely put a patient on medication.
Okay. One item for, again, after the delivery, breastfeeding. What do you say to new moms who try breastfeeding and they feel like they're disappointed or fail? Because I know sometimes it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. What do you tell those mothers?
There are lots and lots of resources in Northwest Louisiana for breastfeeding. All the hospitals have lactation consultants. Mm-hmm. There are private lactation consultants out in town. But the main thing is just to encourage mothers to keep trying. It can be very difficult, especially the first few days, and worrying about the baby getting enough to eat and latching on and things like that. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is don't give up. And if you're still having problems and you're getting frustrated, is to get a lactation consultant. That's probably the best resource of anything. That's better than and I think any OBGYN in town will tell you that the lactation consultants are awesome. They know, I mean, they're great. So that's what I always do, is recommend it to a lactation consultant, mm-hmm. and then give them some positive feedback myself and encouragement.
And then what are some of the benefits of breastfeeding versus bottle feeding?
It's good for the mom because it helps with weight loss. It's good nutrients for the baby.
It's free.
Yes.
Yeah. It's true.
Not a lot of things free anymore.
I would also encourage, if I have a patient who's having a lot of difficulty and actually gone through all of those steps and then still just can't do it, I would just encourage her not to feel guilty if she can't do it. I think that's been such a big push lately, that parents, that moms especially, feel inadequate as a mother if they aren't producing enough milk, and that could lead to postpartum depression or just enhance that. And so if they've gone through all the resources that they can, they've met with lactation consultants, and either they're not producing milk or it's not working for them, it's okay. Babies do survive off of formula. We obviously encourage breastfeeding first, but a mom should not feel guilty if she can't. And I think that's really important to stress to the to the mother.
All right. We have another caller with about 4 minutes left in the show. This is Victor from Lufkin, Texas. Victor, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a pharmacist, and my girlfriend is currently pregnant. And I've looked through all the different prenatal vitamins. And looking through all of them, I actually came across one that was over-the-counter by BrainStrong that has the highest levels of all the different vitamins. But some of them it has a lot of, I've got an extra. I don't know if it can make a difference. It has, like, phosphorus, iodine, magnesium, zinc, copper, and chromium. You know, would these have any added benefit to her that you know of during the pregnancy, or is this just, like, some extra stuff?
Yeah, they're prenatal vitamins are, that's a big market. Mm-hmm. We get reps that come by the office all the time that have a new formulation. They have a new ingredient that they put a little bit more in than another prenatal vitamin. They have omega fatty acids in one. And so they all vary by formulation. And, there's not been any good studies to show that the one over the counter is any worse or any better than the one that you get a prescription from your doctor. So I would say if it says prenatal vitamin and that it's probably just as good as all the rest, but to also encourage to eat a healthy, balanced diet and all that as well.
Just one, we're running out of time here, basically, but one other question that came in has to do with new moms, and they're concerned about losing weight, the weight gain that they had during pregnancy and getting back to their normal weight again. Really, how concerned should they be about that, and do you have any recommendations for the new moms to lose weight?
So the one big thing is breastfeeding does increase the caloric usage, so that's a great way. They need to check with their doctor before they start physical activity. If they've had a C-section or something like that, they want to wait until they've been released by their doctor, so don't start physical activity without being released. Not to worry about it too much, you know. It depends on how much weight you gain in pregnancy, but you can lose it with a healthy diet and exercise. Mm-hmm. And
you certainly don't want to be restricting your diet immediately postpartum, especially if you are breastfeeding, because you do have to eat enough calories. So you don't want to jump immediately to some crazy diet 1 week after delivery, because it could cause a decrease in breast milk or something like that. So sure. Just eating a regular healthy diet without worrying too much about it should be fine.
So the old comment about, you know, eating for two isn't just while the pregnancy is going on. That's
actually more
well.
Important if you're breastfeeding to, quote, eat for two than it is during pregnancy. During pregnancy, you really only need an extra 300 calories. And so I always tell my patients, you're not really eating for two people. You're eating for yourself and a peanut, especially in the beginning of pregnancy. So an extra 300 calories is not that much. It's much more important to eat more after delivery, especially if you're breastfeeding.
Okay. Well, Dr. James Barrow, Dr. Tamara Richards, assistant professors of OBGYN at LSU Health Shreveport, I want to thank you both for being on the air this evening.
Thank you.
It was fun. Thank you.
Yeah.
It was fun. A lot of great calls. And, of course, every week we have this program at 6 o'clock for you. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician or health care provider for all health concerns. Guests on Health Matters are not compensated or not selected by are selected only by relevance to topic. No fees are charged for participation in Health Matters. The show is available for a download from redriverradio.org, and Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Snell. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Community Foundation of North Louisiana and also by the Gables at Spring Lake, Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. I'm your host, Kermit Poling. Thank you for being with us this evening. Join us next Thursday for the Mental Health edition of Health Matters.